Welcome to
my teeming.
Welcome to the Teeming Brain Podcast. Actually, welcome to the very first Teeming Brain Podcast. This is the inaugural podcast. Never done this before. And today our subject is going to be cosmic horror versus sacred terror. And I'm your host, Matt Cardin. I am the founder and editor of The Teeming Brain, which is a blog which is dedicated to exploring the apocalyptic intersection of horror, religion, paranormal, creativity, consciousness, and culture. It is at www.teemingbrain.com. And I assume if you're listening to us, you are a reader of the blog. And you should find this subject very interesting today. We're here with a virtual panel, a virtual conference call round table that grew out of a conversation that took place at the Teeming Brain and at Christianity Today magazine. And we have several interesting people lined up here to be talking about an issue that actually gets right down to the philosophical and even spiritual and religious basis, if there is such, of what the horror genre is all about. So this should be an interesting discussion. But before we get going, I would like to say hello and acknowledge the presence of John Moorhead, because John is a friend, has been a friend of mine and a friend of the Teeming Brain for several years now. And John runs a really excellent blog of his own titled Theofantastique, which is all about the intersection of religious themes and pop culture. And it was John who actually suggested that we have this podcast. So hello there, John.
Hello, good to be here, Matt.
Well, good to be here with you, and I'm glad you're recovering from your Disneyland trip and hope you're ready for a pretty good conversation today about the matters that are of interest to you and me both.
I am. Looking forward to our interactions and talking with the panel. Should be good.
The other people that we have lined up here today for our panel, let me give you a quick rundown. We have Jonathan Ryan. Jonathan is a novelist and a blogger and a columnist, and he writes for the Huffington Post. He writes for Intrepid Magazine, and most pertinent to what we're talking about today, he writes for Christianity Today Magazine. And it was an article of Jonathan's last month in Christianity Today that he will tell us more about here in a minute that actually was the kickoff to the conversation that we'll be having. Hey there, Jonathan.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
We also have Nicole Cushing, and she is an author of Dark and Weird Fiction. And she wrote How to Eat Fried Furries. If you haven't heard of that, that's quite a head trip of a book. And Nicole has a novella coming out next year titled Children of No One. And Nicole has some very strong ideas about the religious or non-religious aspects of horror fiction. Hi, Nicole. It is great to have you here.
Wonderful to be here, Matt.
We also have Peter Biebergall. Peter Biebergall, who studied religion at Brandeis and Harvard Divinity School, and he has published all over the place. He writes about the intersection of pop culture, religion, and science. Peter is the author of the 2011 memoir, Too Much to Dream, A Psychedelic American Boyhood. And Peter is here because he recently had an experience of channeling the spirit and the personality of Arthur Machen, didn't you, Peter?
That's right. It was out for Weird Fiction Review.
Yes, it was for Weird Fiction Review. We should specify that it may not have been entirely literal, but it certainly was interesting. So that's who we have with us, and there's also several more people that you'll hear from in the podcast today who couldn't be with us, but wanted to record their comments in a separate section because they will contribute interesting things to the conversation. So, cosmic horror versus sacred terror. I want to ask you, Jonathan, to get us started. I'm going to ask you to sort of tell us, for those who may not have read your article in Christianity Today, would you tell us what it was that you were getting at in that article?
Yeah, sure. The article was certainly not meant to say that, start the Lovecraft-Machen debate of who's the better writer, even though I happen to prefer Machen myself. It was more to, first of all, it was in Christianity Today, and horror is not exactly a common discussly theme in the magazine, and so I want to get people to thinking about worldviews and things like that. And obviously, one of the worldviews that I wanted to explore was Lovecraft, who was certainly a committed atheist, and Machen, who was certainly not an evangelical Christian. I hope no one here on this panel thinks that I thought that about Mackin, but he certainly was committed to Anglican and committed to his Christianity in that form. And so, and certainly, you know, following the lines of Charles Williams and people like that. And so, you know, I wanted to bring out this because the Christianity wanted a more recent hook on the article. And so, you know, obviously Prometheus and Cabin in the Woods definitely had some Lovecraftian themes going on in the movies. And so it was more exploring the worldview of the movies of how, you know, Joss Whedon and Ridley Scott were trying to circle out of this sort of the existential despair of Lovecraft, who, you know, reading as many articles by him, you know, his article on supernatural fiction and some of his letters and things like that, he himself would not be ashamed to call himself a committed, you know, atheist materialist. But I felt like I was representing his point of view pretty accurately. And so I just thought it was interesting to see Whedon and Prometheus kind of and Ridley Scott trying to work themselves out of this despair, which I didn't feel like they did. And so, you know, with Mackin, I felt like his horror takes on a different spin and focuses more of on an earthy, sacred terror, whereas Lovecraft does more of a spacey, cosmic terror. Now, of course, those categories are not hard and fast, and for the purposes of the article, I couldn't explain, you know, the nuances and the differences, unfortunately, and most of the audience who read Christianity Today, frankly, just wouldn't care, as my editor brutally told me, because I had a whole section on that part. And so, I had to be as concise as possible, and the main argument I was going for was that Mackin gives a way out of the existential despair of Lovecraft's work. That was my key point. And certainly, again, I certainly, you know, prefer Mackin's work as a fiction writer, not necessarily because his worldview tends to line up better with mine. And I was kind of surprised that everyone thought I was pitting Lovecraft against Mackin, which I guess in the article comes out a little maybe stronger than I had intended, but I certainly wasn't doing that. I was more just trying to discuss different worldviews and how artists and films use those discussions.
Well, can you say something more about kind of where you see that distinction between Lovecraft and Mackin and what you see as being the importance of it? I mean, you said a little bit about it, but I wonder if you say more about the, like, the, your, I don't know if you want to talk about it in relation to your own particular religious viewpoint and background, or just kind of explain in more detail what you mean.
Yeah, I think just looking at Lovecraft and Mackin's work specifically, I mean, certainly there is an element of existential despair in Mackin's work. There's no question. There's some cosmic terror going on there. So Lovecraft and Mackin definitely have some overlapping. I think the difference between Mackin and Lovecraft is that Mackin presents more of a way out of the horror. Now, he doesn't obviously do this in all of his fiction, so I want to be careful about overgeneralizing. But I think in general, Mackin's point of view of that, you know, when the veil, you know, as I said in the article, when the veil gets ripped off, there's often two different reactions to it. With Lovecraft, it's often despair. Now, there's definitely some, you know, again, overgeneralizing. But with Mackin, it can be despair, as we've seen a lot of his works, but also it can also be a transformational thing where the person is transformed into something different. And so, you know, I think with Mackin, he was looking to, obviously he was trying to fight against sort of the scientific materialism of his day. So he was trying to present, you know, something beyond the veil, something that just lies beyond our reach, that type of thing. And he wasn't out to convert anybody to Christianity by any means. But he was just trying to get people to really think about what lies beyond the veil, which Lovecraft certainly was doing. It's just I feel like those two have different reactions to what would lie beyond the veil.
I should specify to anybody who's interested in finding the article that it was titled "Meaning to the Madness," "Meaning to the Madness," and it was published on the web anyway on October 10th at the website for Christianity Today.
The original title was "Cthulhu Dying," but they nixed it, unfortunately. they said it was too insider, so I was like, okay, fine.
kind of edgy that you were kind of talking about Lovecraft and Mackin anyway in Christianity Today. That's one of the things that struck me, so I can see why that original title got axed.
Yeah, oh, totally. And, you know, it was definitely a thin line that I was walking. The editor and I shot things back and forth quite a few times, but, you know, that's when you someone pays you to write for their magazine, they have final say and all things.
Well,
so,
sure.
You know, when you're a struggling writer, it's sort of like, oh, yeah. Yeah, and I'm happy with the final content. It was just I liked my title better, but, you know.
Well, it was an engaging article in any case. I might have liked the original title better too. Before I bring some of the others in on this, I wanted to press you on a specific line that you had in there, and I think this might bring us to the heart of some of what aroused the sometimes very passionate expressions of differing opinions in the comments thread at the Teeming Brain over this.
Sure, right. Yeah.
As you know, I published on October 22nd. I published a response to your piece, and
yeah,
I titled it "Cosmic Horror, Sacred Terror, and the Nightside Transformation of Consciousness."
Right.
And I loved your article, and I said that in what I published. And not least, I enjoyed seeing those issues talked about in Christianity Today, which is like the main evangelical magazine publication around.
It is, yeah.
But as you also know, the line that I focused on from your piece was the one where you said, "Through this sacred terror, Mackin created stories richer and more terrifying than anything Lovecraft could conceive." And that right there, I think, for me, and I could tell for the others who came in on the conversation, was the point where what you say, you know, we may have drawn a greater distinction than you intended between the two writers and the two viewpoints of cosmic horror and sacred terror came
sure.
out. And if in fact you were saying that by going the direction of sort of a numinous terror or a sacred terror, where when the veil is removed, there's something that may be terrifying in its own right, but it's sort of a Mysterium Tremendum Rudolph Otto type terrifying that has maybe
sure.
a spiritual or a religious basis to the universe, and that is more is like inherently something that gives a better weird fiction experience or something of more awesome scope or impact or something than a nihilistic cosmic horror. Well, right
sure.
there, I diverged from you, and my point that I wrote was that basically I think you're misreading the distinction as a dichotomy, and that in fact Lovecraft, with his cosmic horror, gets at things and accesses the very same emotional center that Mackin is getting at, but he's doing it in that nihilistic context. So when I say that, what do you think?
I would completely agree with that last line. I certainly, and this is what I said earlier, I think, you know, I think Mackin definitely and Lovecraft access some of the same sort of things. Now, you know, I don't want to be disingenuous here. I'm a very committed Orthodox Christian. You know, I think, you know, with that, I feel like, you know, drawing on some of the passages on the Bible where, you know, people experience this weird stuff going on, and they're, you know, when they see an angel has to tell them to not be afraid. And the Hebrew and the Greek each time is sort of this absolute terror that they're about to come apart. You know, in Isaiah faces God. There's an absolute terror that he feels like he's going to come apart. So there's definitely that. So, and I was also drawing on C.S. Lewis's words that, you know, if we ever come in contact with absolute good, we think that's what we want. And, you know, Lewis says, sometimes we might need to think again. And the whole point is, yes, it certainly would be a spiritual experience of some type, but from my point of view as a Christian, coming in contact with some of the things beyond the veil, sure, I know they're spiritual, but they may not necessarily be any hope in that that process, I guess. And so I think, you know, looking at that, you know, it's a nuanced thing, right? You know, I certainly agree with the statement that Lovecraft and Mackin definitely overlap in what they access in their stories, especially when it comes to weird fiction, that sort of thing. I mean, Lovecraft goes on and on about how Mackin was a huge influence on him and his stories. And so, you know, to say that they never overlap would be totally ignoring all evidence to the contrary. And so, you know, I think, again, in that statement, that was a personal statement. And whether I could prove that or not probably depends on your point of view, I would imagine. You know, I think hearing from other Christian horror writers and people, which there's not a lot of us, and we try not to say we're Christians, we just want to write horror because we feel like the genre has those kind of things in it. And so they understood the distinction that I was trying to make, not saying, is Lovecraft a better writer than Mackin? There are times where there are stories of his that are better than Mackin's, but there's others of Mackin's that I like way more. So it's a difficult thing to whether I can separate my worldview and then my view as a writer and what I prefer in stories and that sort of thing. I don't know that I can untangle that very well for you.
Well, that's fair enough. I think that's a good point. That's something worth talking about. I think we may. And before I get to some of that, before we talk about that with some of the people here on the phone, I want to go for a minute to some to the people I mentioned who wanted to be here but couldn't be here for the group conversation, and we're going to hear what they have to say in response to that exact thing that you were talking about, and then we will we'll come back and join again with the group here. I'm talking with W. Scott Poole, who is a historian, who is a professor at the College of Charleston, and he is the author of Monsters in America, Our Historical Obsession with the Hideous and the Haunting. And this is one of the more interesting and prominent academic books to come out in the area of horror and philosophy in the past couple of years. And Scott, I want to start by saying I appreciate your talking with me.
Thanks, Matt. I appreciate being asked. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
You know the gist of what Jonathan Ryan was saying in his article for Christianity Today.
Yes.
And I know that you're very familiar with Mackin and familiar with the Lovecraft. And
right.
Starting with this distinction between cosmic horror in a nihilistic Lovecraftian sense and sacred terror in a more numinous religious sense, I want to ask you initially just what are your thoughts on that distinction? I mean, in terms of agreement, disagreement, how does that strike you to make that kind of distinction as a fault line running through horror entertainment?
I really don't think it's fair to talk about it as a fault line within horror. I think that probably my primary objection to Ryan's claims in the article was really that, you know, there is this sort of clear distinction and also this suggestion that maybe horror should approach a particular path, that they should follow this sort of sacred terror model of Mackin. I thought it was very interesting in the article that when he sort of reached out to try and find examples of Mackin-esque horror, it was actually really sort of impossible for him to do. He actually talked about the Indiana Jones trilogy, and he talked about Mel Gibson's Signs. And, you know, fine, interesting, okay movies. I'm not sure that, you know, any of us who love horror and think that horror has some meaning even beyond its entertainment value would necessarily put those within the horror tradition. So I actually really felt that, you know, kind of setting up this dichotomy, which I know that that Jonathan Ryan has said that, you know, he really sort of doesn't want to do that. I still think that from the article it's pretty clear that he did. And I almost felt that, you know, here was sort of an example of someone with a very specific belief system who also loves horror and would very much like to see those things fit together in a neat way. And I'm actually just not sure that that's possible. I think that horror may have, as I said, I think that horror does have some meaning beyond itself. I'm not sure that even those sacred meanings are necessarily Christian meanings.
In terms of doing a moral reading of contemporary horror cinema like he was doing, and drawing, like you said, you mentioned the examples that he gave of trying to come up with the sacred terror type as maybe being inefficient or inappropriate or something like that. Do you have any kind of thoughts in this same vein about films or television shows or any contemporary entertainment in the horror genre that might be notable examples of either of either direction that we're talking about, or if they're the same thing, cosmic horror, sacred terror, do you have anything that you would point to as notable examples?
Well, you know, I would actually make the argument that that really all of horror owes a great deal to Lovecraft and a great deal to, you know, sort of this very nihilistic notion of, you know, essentially raising questions about the meaning of human life, the meaning of history. I think that one point, though, that I would just, you know, maybe back up and make about that is that I really think it's odd to put together a comparison of Lovecraft and Macon, in part just because, you know, I think that Lovecraft's influence over the horror genre is absolutely indisputable. And, you know, this is part of the reason why we, you know, since his death, there have been periodic Lovecraft revivals. And now in so many ways, you know, he's sort of recognized as sort of the progenitor of so much in the horror genre. I think it's really hard to make the case that Macon really had that much influence, or that this, to me, sort of very amorphous notion of sacred terror, this sort of idea that somehow Ryan was suggesting is separate from Lovecraft's, you know, sort of look into the void. I just think it's really hard to make that case. I mean, you know, Macon, for one thing, wrote a number of stories that were not horror stories. His sort of horror canon is actually remarkably small, and what we have of that is short, and you know, they're sort of fun ghost stories, but they're not this sort of mythos that Lovecraft created, and they certainly have not been as influential over the horror genre. So, I mean, I think, you know, in a way, my answer to your original question would be it's in a sense hard for me to think of a horror artifact that does not owe a great deal to Lovecraft and this sense.
Actually, I think that may be part of his. It's interesting to hear you circle to there, because I think that may be part of his point in his article was that maybe there should be and that taking a moral reading, because this is Christianity Today magazine, after all, what he was writing in. Taking a moral reading of the current horror cinema, a crop of movies, we see that really there is this sort of spiraling, ever widening emphasis on the despair and possible nihilism of our situation in a Lovecraftian or a quasi Lovecraftian sense, but that Macon was able to get at some of the same ideas and stories that inspired Lovecraft. Even, I mean, he was a big fan, you know, of the great god Pan and the white people and all that.
Right.
That Macon was doing it from more of a mystical view that had an actual sort of a Christian mysticism behind it, and that but this takes one ultimately to a different metaphysical resting point, and that maybe it's too bad that there can't be more of that kind of impulse in cinema that is seeking for something that might end up having sort of an actual religious or spiritual meaning behind it, instead of just accessing this sort of mystical nihilism which just ends up in despair. Does that say anything to you?
Well, I mean, you know, it sort of says to me that, you know, it is a moral reflection rather than a reflection on the actual direction that the horror genre has taken. I think it would also be a mistake to sort of point to kind of recent examples. I know he mentions in the article Sinister and some other films. I think it would be wrong to sort of suggest that horror has gone in a nihilistic direction. I think if we look back at Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Nosferatu and even the early Universal films, I mean, so many of which were sort of these nihilistic comedies about death. I really think that the very roots of horror are in that nihilism, and so it almost leaves Jonathan Ryan just sort of wishing that it might have been different. and I think also you know, wanting in so many ways to sort of make a connection between his own belief system and this genre that he obviously has a fascination with.
You have spoken into a direction that leads me to a sentence from one of your own writings that I wanted to close by presenting you with. You can briefly explain what you mean, and you may have already gotten partly there. As you know, in 2011, you wrote a piece for the Huffington Post that mm-hmm. was titled "Accepting the Monster into Your Heart."
Right.
And the sort of the ringer sentence from it, we might say, was this one. And I want to read this to you and ask you if you can give me and give our listeners maybe a 3 or 4 sentence explanation of what you mean. You wrote,
certainly.
Even the nihilistic impulses of horror offer a meaningful, if challenging, mysticism. What do you mean by that?
I mean that horror invites us to look into the void. And the void may not be what we want to see, but if it is what is, then it's a particularly honest and particularly bracing action, really an act of contemplation to do that. And, you know, horror is a genre that in so many ways keeps us from wish fulfillment, keeps us from wishing for things to be different than they are. And I think that has a great deal of meaning, even a kind of a mystical meaning, even if it's not, even if it doesn't conform to particular religious doctrines.
Scott Poole, thank you very much for talking with me.
Thanks, Matt.
I'm talking now with T.E. Grau, who is an author of a number of things, both that you have seen and that you will be seeing in the future. Recently, he contributed a story titled The Screamer that is getting a lot of good press to a Lovecraftian anthology titled Urban Cthulhu. He is also the author of a forthcoming short story collection to be titled I Am Death, Cry the Vulture. And in fact, he's a co-author with his wife, Ives Hovhaniemi, who is an author and an editor and a screenwriter. And pertinent to the Teeming Brain is the fact that Ted is an author of a column titled The Extinction Papers for the Teeming Brain. And he also participated extensively in the conversation over Jonathan Ryan's article that we're talking about here. So I want to say hello and thank you for appearing on the podcast, Ted.
Hi, Matt. It's fantastic to be here.
So what is it that you disagreed with in Jonathan's characterization of the whole Lovecraftian cosmic horror and nihilism and despair versus Mackin's sacred terror as defining and clashing characteristics of the horror genre?
I think that Mackin, to me, I mean, I've never really, I mean, I guess I didn't know that he was supposed to be like a Christian-type writer because I've always found him to be one who sort of champions the sensual parts of nature and you know, he seems to embrace more of, you know, Greek myth, you know, in stories like the great god Pan and even the, you know, the Hill of Dreams. He talks about fairy folk and ghosts and things like that, which to me doesn't seem to be even remotely Christian, I guess in the modern evangelical term Christianity, which you know, is the Bible is the unerring word of God, and all other things are considered satanic and things like that. So I guess I never noticed that Mackin, or I guess Mackin, I say Mackin, Mackin is you know, was writing from some kind of C.S. Lewis Christian based background, because I found him to be more about almost like writing from the viewpoint of a pagan druid type who just embraced nature and saw nature as being beautiful and full of secrets, and he talks about things behind the veil, and to me that isn't behind the veil to see heaven or to see God or the angels or any of the apostles or anything like that. I always took that to be seeing behind the veil of reality and seeing the things that are more supernatural and uncanny and I guess darker and which ties in more to Lovecraft. So I always saw Lovecraft building off of that more naturalistic, also like Algernon Blackwood and people like that, building off of that more naturalistic horror and then making it more cosmic. So I never saw So I guess, you know, bring it back to this article. I think it's very odd that someone who claims to be a Christian or a modern Christian would champion Machen as this Christian writer, as opposed to, you know, the evil Lovecraft who you know, believes in alien gods and things like that. So I guess I didn't see a juxtaposition between the two. I always saw Lovecraft as building off of what Machen sort of established and making it more cosmic, as opposed to more, you know, based in, like, you know, the mysteries of the natural world here on Earth.
It sounds like what you're saying that you didn't see even the clash at all, let alone like a mischaracterized clash between the two. When Jonathan was writing about that, you just saw Lovecraft sort of building on the same emotional and philosophical and artistic response in horror fiction that he had admired in the other author. Am I hearing you right?
Absolutely, yes. And Machen just seems more like a Gnostic believer, and I guess he didn't embrace his faith until later on in his life, after he had written the bulk of his great weird fiction. And so I think to, you know, embrace him now, you know, because maybe he had, like, you know, a late life conversion to God or something like that, or, you know, more of a an orthodox idea of God, I think is a bit intellectually dishonest, I guess. I mean, I don't know if that's the right term to use for it, but and also in the article, Jonathan said, I mean, he keeps going back to hope about how Machen always uses, because, like, I guess his idea that there's hope in humanity, that is somehow like a Christian ideal, which I don't think, you know, I think that's sort of like co-opting something that everybody appreciates and holds dear, and saying, you know, because Machen writes about, you know, the hope of society, or the hope of humanity, that therefore he's writing from, you know, more of a Christian viewpoint, when I think all of us, it doesn't matter if, you know, if you're the most negative, pessimistic person, or, you know, or whatever, I think that hope is something that we all embrace and enjoy as humans. So,
I mean, well, leaving aside the question for a minute of whether or not the characterization of either author was correct, I'm curious to know, with the few minutes that we got left, what do you make of just the distinction itself? If we take out Lovecraft, mm-hmm. take out Machen, and we just are left with the idea of there being a distinction between cosmic horror as a despairing, dark, bleak thing based on hopelessness and finding its horror in that, mm-hmm. and then sacred terror being maybe a mode of horror that would be more directly related to ideas of the numinous and be more directly rooted in sort of a metaphysical mm-hmm. worldview with an actual spiritual reality, you know, lying at the base of the apex of things. What do you think of that as a characterization of two different trends, two different modes, two different poles that horror can tend towards? Does that speak to you, or do you also take issue with that?
It does. It does speak to me, because, I mean, I'm a horror fan, or a fan of horror in all forms. It doesn't matter if it's cosmic. It doesn't matter if it's about fluffy bunnies. It doesn't matter if it's about whatever. I mean, I think that just, you know, contemplating horror and embracing horror in all of its forms, I think, is important. And, I mean, you know, not to sound you know, sort of crass or whatever, but, I mean, it's fun. So, I mean, if, you know, if there is such thing as sacred horror, I mean, I'm still kind of trying to grasp that. I don't know if it deals with angels and demons or things like that, because I'm having a hard time trying to fit in non-belief in the supernatural, like ghosts, with the general idea of horror. But I think that there's room for all. If you tend towards cosmic horror, I mean, if that resonates with you, and that's something that you enjoy, and it makes you happy, and it unspools your mind, I think that's fantastic. If you are, you know, a Christian, and you want to explore ideas of horror, and if that's the first thing that will lead you down a path to contemplate darker things and maybe other realities and perhaps other truths in this universe, then I'm all for it.
I would gather that it's that, and I think I knew this in advance, but I'm interested to hear you speaking in these terms. It sounds like just the horror response as aroused by what we call horror literature, what we call horror film, is something of value to you, is important to you. What can you, in a sentence or two or three, are you able to articulate what it is that draws you to that and makes you assign an importance to it?
No. I'm just kidding. No, I don't know. I've always found, I mean, even like growing up and like, you know, in a very conservative evangelical home, I always found fascination with the abomination as a, I believe it was Conrad who said that, that there's like, and it's not just like, you know, a train wreck or a car crash or something like that, but something larger, something, you know, out of the boundaries of what I've been taught and what I've ever even contemplated as, you know, as a young kid. And that's, and that fantasy, I guess, which could be reality, I think is important. I think it's important for people to get outside of their box, outside of their head sometimes, and contemplate, you know, cosmic horror, alien gods, you know, a time before the God that we know as God, you know, there were, you know, universes and realms and things prior to that, and also, I mean, to contemplate death and what death means, and is it final, and you know, is there something else out there, and is it heaven, and if it's not heaven, then what is it? And, you know, contemplating fear, you know, the oldest, I'm going to screw up the quote, but the Lovecraft quote talking about, you know, the oldest and most profound fear in humanity is fear of the unknown. And mm-hmm. I think that is the root of good horror is the unknown. And that can come in many different guises, many different forms, many different genres. I think the unknown and the fantastical are very fascinating, and I think that it's important for all of us as humans to at some point contemplate that. And I think, you know, us as horror writers and readers, we contemplate that more often and a lot sooner than most people, I think, who do it maybe like at, you know, in their later years or, you know, prior to actual death. And I just think it's good for the for your mind, and it's good to expand your consciousness to contemplate those sorts of things.
I think probably a lot of people listening to this will be of a mind to agree with you pretty passionately. And I really appreciate your time. Thanks for talking with us today, Ted.
Thank you, Matt. It's been a pleasure.
Richard Gavin is a Canadian author of Numinous Horror, whose name has been getting more and more around in the past couple of years, and who is has a lot of people that are gravitating toward his work because of its really profound and elegant exploration of the very types of themes that we have been talking about in this conversation involving Lovecraft and Mackin and other authors. Most recently, Richard is the author of the horror collection At Fear's Altar, which was published just this year by Hippocampus Press, and I really appreciate Richard joining us to offer his thoughts on the conversation. Opening with just sort of a really general question, seeing where you want to take it, what do you make of the issue at hand?
Well, I think that the distinction that was made, or at least seemed to be being made in the original article that Jonathan wrote, and to his credit, I mean, kudos to him for trying to present an article to show the evangelical Christians that, you know, horror did have merit. I think that the distinction that he was trying to make in Mackin's Sacred Terror being somehow intrinsically superior to Lovecraft's cosmic horror was a little bit false, and I'm in agreement with you when you had presented the notion that really these two writers were perhaps coming at it from different viewpoints, but were essentially striving to evoke that same sense of the numinous, that same sense of cosmic awe, of horror as a mode of awareness, of a depth of awareness. And in that sense, I really see them as comparable. I'm sure Lovecraft saw himself as being in the tradition of Mackin. So I think that really it's almost a difference in terms rather than any sort of philosophical opposition.
So would you think, would you say, as an author who yourself works sort of from the center of what you're talking about, because you have been compared to both Mackin and Lovecraft in the way that you write and the philosophical dark worldview mm-hmm. that you write with and write from, would you say that there is no distinction between, to any degree of the type that Jonathan tries to draw, or if one takes away the idea that we're talking about a strict dichotomy and just wants to recognize inflections or shadings in terms of the basic, metaphysical outlook or moral outlook that they're coming from, would you think that there is some kind of dividing line between the two, or would you kind of more advance further in the direction of what you just said and say that really they are just paralleling each other?
I think it is to a certain degree a level of parallel. I think the difference for me would be that one of the great things that supernatural horror can do, or weird tales if one prefers that term, is it can present very complex and profound and meaningful philosophical or even religious concepts and yet remove them from any particular framework so that the individual reader can explore these themes as she or he sees fit. Where I think the issue is a little bit difficult for me with trying to align Mackin's writing with, you know, let's say the Anglo-Catholic traditions that he later very much clung to, is that it's essentially grafting a morality or using the fiction to buttress a pre-existing systematic worldview, whereas in essence really both of what these men were trying to strive for was the numinous, something that was unknowable to the rational mind, perhaps, but as you use the term, which was deeply resonant with me, the sort of night side transformation of consciousness, we can apprehend it. And I think that level of awareness and appreciation is stimulated by the fiction, and I don't think that it's necessarily. I think Mackin does it equally well as Lovecraft, and they do it in their own ways, following their own obsessions, but ultimately I think it's more a depth rather than a particular idea that they may be trying to get across.
Let's look at the question of cinema specifically, mm-hmm. and ways of applying these ideas there to see what understandings it brings up, because that's what Jonathan was doing in his article. When he therefore says that one can look at current horror cinema and see things like Cabin in the Woods, and see things like Prometheus and many other examples, and discern, as he would say, the Lovecraftian influence, which is obvious from the fact that we know that the writer and director of Prometheus and the writer and writers and director of Cabin in the Woods were consciously influenced by Lovecraft.
Mm-hmm.
But when Jonathan is writing about a philosophical distinction, saying these are Lovecraftian, whereas some of the others he talks about, he brings in Mel Gibson's Signs and a couple of other things. He says these may be getting more in a Mackin-like direction. Would you be inclined to say that Prometheus and Cabin in the Woods and some of the other examples could just as well be talked about in terms of sacred terror as cosmic horror?
I think that they broach a lot of the same themes. This is where it probably gets a little bit difficult, and in a way, I suppose, kind of dovetails with something I was talking about earlier, which was our temptation as human beings to systemize what we're experiencing. The great thing about horror fiction and horror film is that it takes us to the brink of our preconceived reality constructs, our thresholds. It takes us to places in a relatively safe way, in an artistic way, that challenge us and cause us to reassess certain things. So I think if writers or filmmakers are coming from a an attempt to reinforce a sort of preconceived reality construct or a morality structure. In a way, it hobbles the work a little bit. I think it's best done to remove those types of direct reference and instead allow the individual audience member to work those out in their own way. So would I say that the Lovecraftian and Mackin-esque type of cinema, are they equal? Perhaps not. I mean, perhaps Prometheus and Cabin in the Woods were more recognizably Lovecraftian. But the interesting thing with Mackin, and another reason, question I would raise with this whole debate, if you will, is that I don't know how many of Mackin's most enduring works really support a kind of Christian worldview or his Anglo-Catholic worldview. I mean, certainly people remember The White People and they remember the novel of The Black Seal and The Great God Pan. I don't know how much of a sort of Christian worldview or would be inherent in those. I'm not sure if those are the qualities that people are responding to. I think the reason why those works last is that they do have that same sort of invocation of the awesome that we find in Lovecraft and in Blackwood, but in their own unique ways. You could perhaps see a very Mackin-esque film, but I don't know if the elements that an audience would respond to would be ones that would be immediately recognizable to one who was going hoping to see perhaps a more Christian-themed supernatural film.
So once again, we're back to the point where as you said, it dovetails with your thought that really they're heading in the same direction, and therefore if one tries to look at cinema and draw distinctions, you might be able to, but you're even talking about Mackin maybe not doing what the common view of him says.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's my sort of suspicion with Mackin, is that absolutely, you know, I think that the important thing with these writers like Blackwood and Mackin and Lovecraft, is that not so much that they were, I don't think we still read and respond to them because we hope that they will reinforce our worldview or a particular philosophical system that we subscribe to per se. I think what has the emotional resonance for a lot of readers is that we encounter these rare writers who aren't so much manufacturing stories as they are conveying very profound and very personal impressions of the universe, of existence. And I think that is really the underlying power of these writers. I think it has a great deal to do with their endurance, why we still feel this sort of deep resonance with them, because we seem to have found people that were the genuine article, that were conveying their own very unique perspective on a deeper universe, on a universe that is conscious, that is not necessarily designed for us, on a world that is inherently spiritual, that has an invisible, an ineffable quality that many of us recognize. And I think that is ultimately the important part. I don't even think Lovecraft's nihilism is as important as, say, Blackwood's more pagan consciousness stories or Mackin stories that perhaps have this sacred terror. I think ultimately what we're seeing are people who are conveying the world as they felt it, as they saw it, as they experienced it. And we, as readers, resonate with that because we, too, engage in the world and we do look up at the stars and we do enter the woods and they do seem eerie at night. So I think it's that sort of primal level storytelling that really affects us and really makes these types of writers crucial, particularly in the 21st century.
And maybe that's why, one of among several reasons why we are seeing such things being talked about, not only in some of the customary venues that we would expect, cosmic horror, sacred terror, et cetera, and these authors to be discussed in, but now even in places like the uber evangelical magazine Christianity Today.
That's right, which is, as far as I'm concerned, a fantastic thing. I mean, anything that sort of draws attention to these kinds of writers, and, you know, who knows, there may be very devout Christians who find deep resonance with Lovecraft, you know, who or with some of Mackin's stories, perhaps that we would not expect, you know, that we would not be able to perceive. They may sense that same depth that we do in a unique way. So I think that it is terrific that it is reaching these other venues. The important thing is, of course, to realize that because these writers were coming from a very individual perspective, that they are transmutable to all kinds of different spiritual traditions, to philosophical systems, and that's a great thing.
All right, now I want to hear back with the group conversation from Nicole, because I know, Nicole, you had some very strong thoughts and feelings in response to what was being said, and I don't know if you want to get how personal you want to get, but Jonathan was telling us a few minutes ago about his personal religious position, that he is an Orthodox-minded Christian. I believe this is distinctly different from where you're coming from, and I think that your understanding and your response to a horror fiction is decidedly different. What can you tell us about that?
My point of view for right now, I mean, I'm always open-minded, and I'm open to changing. My whole credo is basically to follow the truth wherever I find it, and where that's taken me at this point is a position of atheism, you know, but also a position of alternating with some humanism, and also alternating with existentialism, and also alternating with pessimism in a kind of Schopenhauer kind of sense. So I just try to follow what I feel the truth of the matter suggests, and that's in my youth I definitely read Lewis and found him convincing, I think, because I wanted to be convinced. And at this point have deviated that pretty substantially.
Well, and how does that play into the way that you responded to what Jonathan was saying about and also to what I was saying in response to what he was saying about the distinction between Lovecraft and Mackin? Because I've sensed from having seen you talk about this before that you really didn't have much of a liking, maybe even less of a liking than I had, for the idea that Mackin, because he was coming at things from the viewpoint of the veil containing something that may be terrifying but is still divine behind it, being more effective for that reason than Lovecraft talking about nihilism.
Well, I mean, in some ways, I want to start off by just challenging a little bit the premise that Lovecraft and Mackin are as different as this discussion is leading us to believe. If we look at the details of Mackin's work, and I have not read a huge amount of it, but I've read his signature story, The Great God Pan, I find some things in there that challenge the idea that they're as opposite as they might seem. For example, there's this idea, you know, articulated by the gentleman who wrote Mr. Ryan, the author of the Christianity Today piece, that Mackin offers us a way out of existential despair. While in his story, The Great God Pan, you know, there are no less than five suicides. There's this idea that Mackin is suggesting that we not pay attention to scientific materialism, but the way in which the divine experience is triggered in The Great God Pan is a brain operation, which is certainly, I think, the most atheist, materialist neuroscientist could say, yeah, if you mess around with someone's brain, you probably will get them to experience the divine. If we look at just the structure of that story, where you have a young girl named Mary, who is the vessel for a divine incarnation, and her progeny is Helen, who is in Greek mythology. Helen of Troy was, you know, the offspring of Zeus and Leda, Leda and the Swan from that story. And I think what Machen is really reflecting is this fear that Christian hegemony is going to end, and this idea that there are latent pagan forces, the old religion, that's going to reassert itself. And it's a very Victorian idea, and actually in a way not all that different from Lovecraft's fear of the incursion of foreigners. It's just a different kind of focus. Neither one of them being particularly admirable, actually, if we think about it that way. So, and as far as comparing the two authors, I think one of the great bases that we can make for that comparison would be to compare the great god Pan to, I think, what probably would be Lovecraft's take on it, which would be the Dunwich Horror. And I find the Dunwich Horror to just be much more imaginative, you know, rather than just having one offering, we have two, and one of them is kind of invisible, and the other one's this 8-foot-tall person, and, you know, it seems a lot more imaginative than what Machen was able to bring, which is basically reverting to past mythologies to kind of, you know, to do his thing, whereas Lovecraft is creating a whole other mythology of his own, surely not independent of some of those other mythologies. But he's taking more of an imaginative leap. So, as someone who appreciates the imaginative, I find that it just has greater oomph for me. So that's one of my first points I want to make. The second point I want to make is, you know, having basically a materialist point of view, the idea of sacred terror, I think, owes a lot to our heritage as social primates with a dominance hierarchy. And this is something that you can, you know, there's a great book by Carl Sagan called The Varieties of Scientific Experience, where he talks about kind of, you know, putting God under the microscope and looking at, you know, why religion may have evolved and kind of how our dominance hierarchy past kind of informs that. And when we bow our heads in prayer, we're basically emulating an experience that mammals do when they submit to a superior mammal. Right? So these are maybe very old instincts and very old actions and behaviors that may be hardwired into us when we're responding to something that's dominant to us. And so I think what sacred terror implies is that there's something inherently benevolent, right? I mean, sacred implies that's a good thing, right? And I think in our culture, and not just in our culture, but in all our cultures and our species, we have a stratification according to status, and so the sacred terror is just kind of taking that to the nth degree. And the kinds of experiences that people report when having the sacred terror are very similar to the kinds of fear that a child has when confronting an adult who kind of catches them doing something bad, or just that relationship between the divine and the human is often analogized to a parent-child relationship. And I think there's, you know, these are all impulses that if we were a different species that wasn't based on a dominance hierarchy, I think we might not have a god at all, or we would have a very different kind of god that wasn't hierarchical. So I think this is a vestigial aspect of our humanity, and where basically there's this idea of that which we do not understand, we cower before, or we tremble before, or we submit to. If it's bigger and it's unknown, we cower and we submit, and that's just probably a survival aspect. As far as horror fiction goes, I think, you know, the way I approached it is, this stuff ain't going away. This is hardwired into our being. This is very old stuff. This is reptile brain stuff or social mammal stuff, and we're social mammals and we're kind of stuck here. But what we can do with it is use it as a scaffold or use it as a skeleton on which to build horror stories, because that relation to the unknown and the and that which is bigger and unknown is something that you know is going to induce that experience, because we are who we are, biologically. But we can take that and we can graft ideas into that place of the divinity. And that's where you see, I think, some really interesting work happening, not just in Lovecraft, but I think even more so in Thomas Ligotti's work, where you see references occasionally to the god Azathoth, or you see the great black swine, or you see the Salau And these, you know, Thomas Ligotti does not believe that these are actual entities, right? I mean, these are symbols for ideas of emptiness, blackness, meaninglessness, purposelessness, etc. And so it's a way of discussing something in a narrative form, in a fictional form, that would be we'd be unable to discuss otherwise because it's too nebulous. And so we go ahead and we give these ideas characterization and personification, and then we can interact with them, and then we can kind of see what they do, and we can insert them into narratives. And that's I think they're really helpful for the horror author, and that's how I try to use them. And you know, in the upcoming novella I have, there's a god of nothingness, right, called the Great Black Mouth. I don't really believe that there's a great black mouth out there that I can invoke through rituals, right? Even though that's what the characters in the book do, but I do that because I want to talk about the idea of of the nothingness, right? Of the emptiness. I find that appealing to talk about, and I find it kind of interesting to explore. And that way, that's the only way I can do that.
When I'm listening to you, I think I'm probably like the others who are here for our roundtable. You're sparking all kinds of thoughts going all over the place, and I just want to observe that what you describe just comes right down to one of the major distinctions, or the major distinction that stands between cosmic horror and sacred terror, as Jonathan was framing it, and as you're describing the reptile brain and our atavistic side that is still with us through eons of evolution and that we can symbolize and express in horror fiction. It sounds like you're doing a very nice exposition of a point that I think Lovecraft would have agreed with you very strongly about, as we all know from the opening section to his essay Supernatural Horror in Literature. And at the same time, not contradicting this, but just adding different light on it, it fascinates me, and I want to actually use this to switch to just ask, to pick Peter's brain for a minute to ask what he thinks. It fascinates me, Nicole, that what you're saying walks the divide between two different views of where the experience in question of a sort of the numinous side of whether we're talking about cosmic horror or cosmic terror or sacred terror comes from, because from sort of the religious side of it, one would be talking about what you might call sort of a top-downward causation, like there actually is something ontologically, you know, metaphysically or ontologically that is at the basis of whatever it is that we may still be just working with in symbols that are abstracted from the original itself. Whereas on the side you're talking about, there really is a nothingness, and like your god of nothingness is just pure symbol, sort of a pure expression of something that doesn't have any real basis in anything that exists ontologically. That seems to me to be the divide, and you can say more about that later. I'd love you too if you want to. Peter, turning to you as the guy who in the fictional form channeled Mackin not long ago, what do you think about this? I mean, the characterization we're getting of the two different types of fiction and the way Mackin and Lovecraft oppose each other or parallel each other? What's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, this has really been an amazing discussion, Nicole. Thank you so much for really getting us moving in an incredible direction. I mean, I think you mentioned Rudolf Otto, and I think that he's essential here to this conversation because he really wants to, he suggests that first encounter, whether you go on and build a religion out of it or whether you go on and carve an idol or build a fire is born out of that encounter with the mysterium tremendum, right? That awfulness that Jonathan was talking about. That I think is in it doesn't matter who your god is. I think it's what people were experiencing in their rites to Pan and what people can experience in the biblical stories, and I think we sadly have less of those experiences because I think religion has become so mediated that we have lost sort of the that immediacy of the relationship that the human being can have with whatever kind of I'll use the word divine, but I want to be clear that, you know, I'm often using that word metaphorically. I'm using it in a narrative sense. I think it's also important to recognize that we're talking about fiction here. It's a little unfair, in a way, to talk about whether or not either of these authors were atheists or believers. It's only because we know that about them that now we're going to impose that upon what we think their writing is trying to do, rather than reading their work, you know, sort of as it, just standing alone and trying to gather some interpretation from it based on the writing itself. But I think that what Otto does that's very important here is that the difference for him, I think, between Cosmic Horror and Sacred Terror is that for Sacred Terror, on the other side of that moment of the encounter with the Mysterium Tremendum is the possibility for a moral life and for an ethical life that has a ground to it. And that's not to say that a nihilist doesn't have an ethic, but simply to say that for Otto, that's what then religion becomes, that it's the construction and the ritualized ethical living that comes about as a result of that encounter, that the encounter is absolutely the first step. You don't have anything else you do before that is just a contrivance, and anything else you do after that is a contrivance, because all you really have is that essential encounter. And I think Macken, I think that for what we can see in his writing, which is, I think, really brilliant, is that he plays with that tension, I think, much more than Lovecraft does, that he recognizes that there is this wavering that can bring you either towards nihilism or towards an ethic, or towards a kind of religious grounded ethic, let's say. And that in that moment of the encounter with this Mysterium Tremendum, you could go either way. And I think his stories give us both those experiences. I think actually the Great God Pan is the least of his stories that deal with this. I think The White People is a much better example of this kind of encounter with something that is so unnatural that it turns into something almost diabolical, whereas the other side of that is something that's a little bit more, again, about trying to... let me say this. I think it goes to the heart of, if we're going to be talking about them as people, his relationship to the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. So before Macken became a very devout Christian, he was a magician, and he was hanging out with Waite and with Crowley and with Mathers in the halls of the Golden Dawn, right? And so, and we often talk about the dissolution of that order as a result of personalities, which it definitely was, and Waite and Crowley hated each other, and there was all the stuff with Mathers' wife and all this stuff. But I think at the root of the dissolution of a lot of these magical orders is the conflict between the mystical and the magical. And I think that for somebody like Macken, that he ultimately saw that magic was not going to lead him towards this, towards the Mysterium Tremendum in a way that he saw on the other side of it, this ethic. This sort of divinely grounded ethic. I think he saw magic alone was just going to devolve into a kind of ego-driven nihilism. And so his turn to Christianity is also his turn away from magic. And you can see that, I think, in the evolution, in fact, of his stories and how his early stories, like The Great God Pan, are very much, you know, playing with some of this tension in a very pulpy way. And then when you get to his later stories and his, like the story of the Angels of Mons and, you know, sort of the World War II British soldiers being saved by the Angelic Host, you know, you start to see that even in his writing there's this transformation of where he thinks that there's a necessity in terms of how does one really have an authentic encounter with the divine? And so, yes, you know, he is a believer. And so it's very hard to separate, as much as I think it's unfair. I think we can still read that into his stories. I personally also think that he, I think his subtlety is what makes him a slight, you know, many of his stories a little bit richer than some of Lovecraft's. I'm always on the fence about Lovecraft. I don't find much of, I love the mythos and I love what other writers have done with it, but I think like Algernon Blackwood is fallen above a more interesting writer on these themes. For example, I think The Willows deals with this question maybe even better than Mack and Lovecraft combined do. I urge everybody to read that story. It's actually available at Gutenberg.org.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that ultimately for Mackin, it's about a divinely grounded moral life that cosmic horror at the end of, on the other side of it, can't offer. It just offers more nothingness, like Nicole's talking about. It just offers more of the abyss, more sort of an eternal question. And I think that Mackin is the kind of seeker that wants to have some, for good or bad, whether you agree or not, wants to have some answer to what it means to have had that encounter. Where is it going to bring you? Is it going to bring you towards? Is it going to bring you towards ego, will, or is it going to bring you towards a divine will, towards moral life? And you know, I think that he does a very good job of not ending up becoming a moralist in his short fiction, and I think that's definitely a danger. Often, I think, you know, people talk about, there's the movie of Anna Karenina right now that everybody's talking about, and it's been said that Tolstoy, when he was writing Anna Karenina, that's when he converts to Christianity and has his revelation, and it's halfway through the book that suddenly Anna Karenina is no longer a sympathetic character. And now he despises her adultery, right, because of his Christianity. So, you know, I don't think Mackin
and
does
Mackin,
that.
Mackin was definitely anti-Puritan, if you read
Yeah, definitely. And I think he wrote crazy, weird horror fiction. You know, he loved
right,
the old
right,
gods.
Right.
I think he was inspired by these old gods and understood how seductive, you know, the talking stones could and the singing flowers could be to you. But I think ultimately he didn't see that that's where one could find an authentic and lasting spiritual and moral life.
We have uncovered some interesting depths here. Sounds like we've gotten to the point where what you're talking about, Peter, is the way that people like maybe that either author, but especially Mackin, was using his fiction as a, I don't know if you'd call it a vehicle of transformation, definitely a vehicle for exploring ideas of transformation, because that's what I gathered from some of the vocabulary that you were using there. Am I hearing you right?
I think so, but I want to make sure that I think that he was still doing what Nicole wants all fiction writers to do, which is remain, when you're writing fiction, to write fiction. And to not try to be saying anything literal. And I think that that's really, I think it's important for both Lovecraft. I mean, I get, you know, chaos magicians want to turn Lovecraft into a believer of some kind, right? Whose gods mm-hmm. we can actually somehow have an encounter with. And I think he would have abhorred that, right? So I think, you know, the way in which we want to, we can impose the literalism, but I think that both Mackin and Lovecraft do a very good job of not literalizing their beliefs inside of their fiction.
Certainly,
use them as vehicles for exploring that.
And what Jonathan's Christianity Today article was talking about was not just these opposing issues of Lovecraftian cosmic horror and Mackin's sacred terror and the different worldviews and motivations and philosophies that they might represent, but the way that that as he sees it, it's much more of the Lovecraft approach that one sees playing out in the sensibility and the ideas behind a whole lot of current horror cinema. And Jonathan was writing about a sort of a dearth, a lack of the other side, the non-Lovecraft side, you know, the non-despair-filled side that seems like it's in there. And to I want to ask John, who is an expert on the religion and pop culture connection. That's what he does. That's one of the things he writes about. I want to ask you, John, based on everything that's said here, what's your diagnosis of the current state of horror fiction or horror film in relation to what we're talking about? Does Jonathan put his finger on something when he says there's kind of a one-sided representation of these two possible directions that we're seeing in the genre right now?
Well, I think my take on this, some of my comments on your fine blog in regards to this are not so much coming down on the side of either author. That's not really my interest in this. I was kind of interested more in the meta ideas behind this that these two authors seem to symbolize. And in our conversation here in this podcast, we've brought in a number of interesting strands, the Christian, the atheist, and now the Western esoteric strand in all this. So even though we have to keep in mind these writers are writing fiction and resist the temptation to see them as literalizing whatever metaphysical or religious ideas may have been behind their own personal views that may have influenced their fiction writing, nevertheless, they are, of course, connected to their own personal beliefs, and they have real-world implications for us to be thinking about. And I think much of contemporary horror does reflect a very nihilistic angst that's in the air. I think my colleague Scott Poole, who wrote Monsters in America, would agree with that. He and I were recently a part of a panel discussion on religion and zombies and ethics at Emory University, and we kind of had an overlap and a point-counterpoint in this regard, in that we agree that horror, particularly in the zombie subgenre, does reflect a very strong nihilistic kind of struggle, which relates to our present concerns today. We live in, not as I think Scott has framed it in the past, post-Christian, but rather a post-Christendom Western world where the Christian church is no longer viewed with credibility. It no longer has a strong and dominating place of positive influence in the public square. It's more of a pluralistic environment where many people are identifying the nuns with atheism, agnosticism, and other non-institutionalized form of spirituality. And so with that loss of the Christian narrative playing a dominant place in pop culture, including in horror, I think we've seen a resulting increase in nihilism in contemporary horror. So where I find myself here, curiously, is disagreeing with both interpretations of this particular area. I want to disagree with my fellow evangelicals, although I'm not an evangelical, as in most Americans identify more with a British form of evangelicalism, in a number of areas. I want to disagree with my fellow evangelicals and those in other Protestant Christian traditions who keep horror at arm's length and see it as being incompatible with the Christian faith tradition. I think both you and I, Matt, have made good arguments in various venues for the fact that there is a dark element in religion, including in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and therefore horror is compatible with even the evangelical Christian tradition. On the other hand, I also want to disagree with the more atheistic and secularists who would agree with many of the assumptions, interestingly, of the evangelicals in saying that, yeah, it's incompatible, and therefore horror as a genre points the way towards nihilism, and that's the only possible and legitimate expression of it. I've tried to disagree and put forward kind of a middle way, and I did this in my chapter in the new book, The Undead and Theology, co-authored or co-edited with Kim Paffenroth. And in my chapter looking at zombie walks and zombie Jesus, I put forward some considerations for scholars and theologians that we need to recognize this nihilistic strand in horror, but that nevertheless one can articulate a theology of hope in cultural engagement, drawing upon horror and pop culture.
This Jonathan, there's two things I'd like to say. You know, first, you know, Stephen King said that you know, fiction is telling lies to tell the truth, and or some abbreviation paraphrase of that. And, you know, I think to say that we can keep our worldview out of our fiction is almost an impossibility. And I think to ignore those questions is a bit disingenuous, because every writer has their point of view, and it will inevitably sneak in their writing. The difference will be, are you going to be so moralistic about it, as in some Christian fiction that's on the shelves right now, where it's just a sermon disguised as a fiction story, which is horrific, or are you going to have, you know, something a little more subtle, something a little more like Mackin and those sort of stories, and Charles Williams, who's one of my favorites as well. I think it's there's no way to, as a fiction writer, that I can sit here and say I keep my worldview out of my stories 100%. That would just be a lie and not being truthful. I think all fiction writers do their best to tell a good story, because it's to serve the story first and the characters first. And I certainly think Mackin is interested in telling good stories, but his worldview inevitably leaked through as Lovecraft did. And I don't think anybody needs to apologize for that, whether you're an atheist or a Christian or not. It doesn't really matter. I mean, I think to apologize for your worldview and what you're writing from as a fiction writer is a bit silly and wrong, frankly. Two, I think with Mackin, to go back to Nicole's example about the surgery at the beginning of Great God Pan, it sort of demonstrates a complete dichotomy that we have in a culture of, you know, it's either science or it's spirituality. And a Christian point of view would take the point of view that physical things happen and awful spiritual things result. So, for example, in The Great God Pan, you know, she's having the surgery, and he flips on a switch in her brain, and all of a sudden she sees The Great God Pan. And so, you know, as a Christian, we would say, sure, physically, scientifically, that's what happens. She'll flip a switch on her brain, and she'll experience something else. But that doesn't leave out that there's not a spiritual explanation there. And I think, you know, Christians in America have contributed to this misunderstanding, because we want to have this dichotomy between earth and heaven, and that is not a Christian point of view. It's more of a Platonic Christianity that actually has no place in Orthodox Christianity, which is one of my reasons, my disagreements in the evangelical circles, because we say it's either physical or it's spiritual, and it can't be both. Whereas the Judeo-Christian point of view, as represented in the Hebrew Scriptures and the New Testament, there's no distinction. And so we're dealing with, you know, 500 years of false information from a certain brand of Christianity that sort of feeds our whole thing. Personally, and I think John takes the same sort of point of view, you know, there's enough in science, you know, we find out how things work. And I would probably agree with everything Nicole said about, you know, our natural tendency might be to bow, our natural tendency might be to do this. And I'm like, absolutely, of course. But doesn't negate the possibility that God doesn't exist and that it wasn't inherently in the creation to bow in the first place. And I think Mackin was really writing against that sort of dichotomy between scientific materialism or the Puritan side, which he despised, by the way, where it was a very pietistic, very, you know, otherworldly mind, you know, head in heaven and your mind on nothing else. Mackin felt, and Charles Williams and Lewis and some of these guys who came from that strand of thought, was that and you can see this in Charles Williams' book, All Hallows Eve, that the unseen and the seen are sort of bound together. And it can often result, you know, we flip on the switch scientifically and maybe we see what's behind the veil. We don't know yet. The question's still out. So I would be careful about driving real hard and fast distinctions because, again, you know, Mackin was trying to get away from an extremely Puritan, pietistic view of Christianity and also scientific materialism and be like, it doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be both and, which is a very Hebrew, way of viewing the world, and certainly a Christian view of the world early on as well.
Of course, when you start talking about that, it's going way back in time, you know, to several millennia back with a background. I wanted to ask, as it was almost like a last shot question to anybody, and I don't necessarily want to call Nicole out, but I know, Nicole, that you don't have a whole lot of time left. You can stay with us, so I don't know if you want to take this or what, but I want to ask you or anybody about your thoughts. This has been playing in the back of my head, an idea that has been put forth by several scholars of horror fiction. S.T. Joshi has mentioned it, and I believe Peter Penzoldt and his great study of supernatural horror in the mid-20th century got at it. There's this idea around that supernatural horror as such, in the way we think of the genre these days and have for the past couple centuries could not have existed before the advent of scientific materialism, could not have existed before there was a full-bore thrust as it went through Western civilization to disenchant the world and to doubt and deny the existence of all the transcendent spiritual and religious realities that had basically undergirded pretty much everybody's view of things for as far back as Western civilization goes. The idea is that you couldn't have a proper idea of the supernatural and therefore create a genre that draws certain effects from it if you didn't have the idea of the natural as what really exists before you, so that then you could, you know, draw horror from the idea of something beyond it that has supposedly been discredited. Anybody, when we hear that, you know, Rudolf Otto and the idea of the holy, as we've talked about, locates the origin of human religiosity in this ancient experience of what he called demonic dread, and he says that basically ghost stories and horror stories had their origin in the same place. And when we hear Jonathan talking about ideas of sacred terror that go back thousands of years, it sounds to me like there might be some disagreement at this idea that that supernatural as something intrinsically horrifying, you know, it is something that was created by modernity. Nicole, anybody?
Well, I don't have a whole lot of time left, but I will chime in with this. I think maybe it's just a matter of language. We say supernatural at this point because we have an idea of what is known and what is unknown, and what is unknown can be fear-inducing. Now, I would argue, I would actually take issue with Lovecraft when he says that, you know, basically the unknown, fear of the unknown is the greatest fear because, you know, for example, we all know that we're going to die. That's the most known thing in the world, and I think that's probably what induces a lot of fear more than the unknown even. But I guess, I think, you know, it's just different language. For example, in pre-scientific days, it may have been a different group of people who were, you know, who would have induced the fear. The fact that when you were traveling across the ocean and you saw a different group of people and they were on horses and, or, you know, those folks with horses came to us and, you know, we kind of envisioned them as being one big creature that's, you know, kind of like a centaur kind of thing. You know, that we might have just had different language for it, but it was probably the same thing. When people looked at the stars and when people saw a lunar eclipse back in the old days, right, when we didn't know what that was, you know, that they inserted something into that gap. And I think that's where the supernatural tends to, just in our culture, tends to go. There's a great talk that Neil deGrasse Tyson gave called The God of the Gap, where he basically goes throughout scientific history where, you know, very bright people have inserted the supernatural where at the limits of their knowledge. There's even that passage, I think, in the book of Job where, you know, Job is being lectured by God, and God is saying, you know, who are you to challenge me? You don't know how big the earth is. Well, these days we do know the circumference of the earth, right? We do know these things. And so, you know, I think the numinous or the divine is always going to be called that at the limits of our knowledge, and we can say, you know, we can nowadays we might equate that with science and what can't be explained by science. I think it would have existed in another form with a slightly different definition of terms in the past. And with that, I'm going to have to unfortunately go. But it's been a wonderful conversation, y'all.
Oh, thank you.
I appreciate you.
I'm actually going to have
thank
to
you.
Go as well. Peter, but I just also want to end with by saying that apropos of nothing that we're talking about, but I can't think of anything sadder than a completely disenchanted world. And sometimes that enchantment is about an encounter with something that's absolutely terrifying. And it should be. And I believe that the more authentic religious experience is one that pushes us up against this thing. There's a great Hasidic tale of a rabbi that says, that he loved God, but he didn't fear God. He loved God, but he didn't fear God. And every night he would pray, God, please let me fear you. Please let me fear you. And finally, God instills the fear of God into him, and he crawls under his bed and says, God, please take away this fear. Now I can't love you. So So there's that inherent tension with this relationship to, I mean, it's difficult, I think, to talk about these things. The atheist-believer dichotomy can make this a very complicated discussion, because I think that I think in some ways the scientific revolution has forced spiritual ideas to literalize themselves to keep pace with what they saw as a threat from a very positivistic worldview. And so then I think religion and spiritual ideas begin to lose that direct encounter, which by its very nature can only be described in metaphor, can only be described in story, it can only be described through narrative. But when religion feels threatened enough that it has to use the language of science to talk about something that was once a grand metaphor, something terrible happens, I think, to it.
And one notices that when you talk about speaking about certain things only through metaphor, from the one viewpoint that we have been talking about and examining, the metaphor would be something that is raising up a supernatural or a spiritual reality from a cosmic condition where no such thing exists. And the other, sort of, you might say in classic mystical fashion, is presenting a metaphor that is necessarily a reduction into humanly understandable terms of something that is real but completely transcends the human ability to grasp or understand or articulate intellectually or verbally.
Right. And this is a common theme in Christian theology for 2,000 years. I mean, Christian theologians from St. Augustine and on have always said that, you know, we can never know God fully, and there's always a mystery about it. There's always, you know, and the things that we know about God are sort of metaphors and ways of describing that God uses. And so, you know, I think that's perfectly within that tradition of what you guys are saying.
This may be a good time for us to wind down. I want to thank everybody for being here. Jonathan Ryan, Nicole Cushing, Peter Bibergall, John Moorhead, thank you all for being here. Very much appreciated.
Thanks so much, Matt.
And this has been the Teeming Brain Podcast number one. I'm Matt Carden. I'm the founder editor of the Teeming Brain at www.teemingbrain.com. And I'm going to put some program notes up. You can go to the website and look for our podcast page to find out more information about everybody who was here. Thanks again, everybody.
Many of the characters and events you will see.